The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
We are Hamas!
Yeah, yeah. You're Hamas, wow. That's a good one. You're what? You're Hamas?
Yes, we're all Hamas, pig!
Long live Hamas!
Civilization, and then say ignore injustice. We are so proud of you. Keep it up, and we honor you because this is Colombia. Thank you.
Repeat after me. Walk and take a step forward.
Yeah, I absolutely feel threatened.
Take a step forward.
So that we can.
So that we can.
Start to push them.
Start to push them.
Out of the camp.
Out of the camp.
One step forward.
One step forward.
Another step forward.
Another step forward.
Viva, viva Palestina!
What does the vest give you, like, as far as
Bellator?
Go Hamas! Long live Hamas and the rebellion!
My Lord, let's go.
We give it a few minutes to clear this area. Points of egress are High Street or Wall Street. No one will stop you from leaving. If you do not leave, you will be arrested. We will give you time to leave. If you do not leave, you will be arrested.
Scenes from over the weekend on the campuses of America's most prestigious universities filled with anti-American, anti-Semitic terrorist sympathizer. That was Columbia University. That was Yale. Those are the greatest colleges in the United States filled with terrorists. You heard them chanting, "Long live Hamas. Go Hamas." They were pointing at some of the Jewish counter-protesters holding Israeli flags. And they said, these are Hamas's next victims. They cheered as the U.S. flag was torn down from a flagpole. They wanted to remove the Jews from their midst. And then that administrator there saying, you represent us. This is Columbia. The administrators sitting on their hands doing nothing about it. Well, we'll get back to that in a moment. Welcome back to The Trumpet Daily. I'm Sam Livingston. I will be your guest host on today's show. Like Mr. Stephen Fleury said, last week. He will be out most of this week. Hopefully we might get an appearance from him over Zoom some point later on this week, but he will be off for most of this week. Email any comments you have, td@thetrumpet.com. Don't forget about our upcoming visit with Dinesh D'Souza on May 5th. He will visit our campus here. He'll watch Celtic Throne. He'll tour the exhibit, and then he'll give a live lecture that evening. You can buy tickets now available at armstrongauditorium.com. And then on May 6th, he will be with us here in studio on the Trumpet Daily for an interview. So look forward to that again on May 5th and May 6th. So what you saw there in that cold open, those were the best universities in the United States training extremists, training anti-American protesters. We commented on this article, this was a few weeks ago, or maybe a few months ago. It was not long after the October 7 attack. And this is an article by Peter Wood. It's titled, "Higher Ed Support for Hamas Exposes Disdain for America in Top Colleges." He writes, "If you don't like the pro-Hamas demonstrations by American college students, then you won't like American higher education, which is the garden in which these flowers were grown. Within hours of the atrocities committed by Hamas operatives who invaded Israel on October 7th, groups of American college students had organized to express their support for the terrorists. This caught many Americans by surprise. How could college students at some of America's best universities sympathize with the perpetrators of gruesome attacks on unarmed civilians?" And you saw it in that video, and it's not coincidence that that lines up with Passover. And they're attacking Jews. It was like a pogrom on these campuses. Jewish people were prohibited from entering sections of campus because they were wearing a yarmulke. Peter Wood says, "The surprise, however, was not universal. If you've been watching these campuses, if you've been watching the radical left in the United States, like the Trumpet has, like Mr. Armstrong has been, since the 30s and 40s, this shouldn't surprise you." Wood writes, "The surprise, however, was not universal. Those of us who pay close attention to American higher education were well aware of the rising tide of anti-Semitism on many campuses, and aware as well of the anger that these institutions had honed against Israel and the sympathies they had cultivated for Palestinian radicals." He says, "Although all these explanations have something important to say about higher education's support for Hamas, I think disdain for America is the most significant. American higher education, at least since the late 1960s, has been disenchanted with Western civilization." Those protesters, those rioters, they hate the United States. They reap all of the benefits of going to these universities. I mean, Columbia is $90,000 a year to attend. We'll talk about in a little bit. One of those protesters that was arrested that day, daughter of Ilhan Omar, the mega oppressed congresswoman from Minnesota, she sends her daughter to Columbia. Her daughter was one of the protesters there. But they hate the United States. And they're being taught that in these universities that are supposed to represent the best and the brightest of America. They actually are the worst. They're attacking, actively attacking this nation. I'll just cover some details of what happened over the weekend. This is the New York Post. "Police storm Yale University's campus with riot gear, arrest students as hundreds stage anti-Israel protests. Police clad with riot gear swarmed Yale University's Connecticut campus early this morning and started arresting students who had been staging an anti-Israel protest encampment there for several days. This was going to be a little autonomous zone for them on this campus. It says cops started warning protesters they risked being arrested if they didn't clear out. So finally, the administration had enough, and they won't come out and say anything, you know, vocally to condemn them. They'll constantly say, well, free speech is important, and they crossed the line because it was hard for some of the other students to get to their classroom. They won't say they were targeting the Jewish students trying to get to their classes. We can't go that far. We had to remove them because a few students weren't able to get to their classes. The Post says while the arrests were underway, others could be heard taunting the Yale Police Department, yelling YPD or KKK, IDF, they're all the same, and chanting Arab blood is not cheap for the martyrs we will speak, comparing the police, those precious police, calling them members of the KKK. I mean, where are the Democrats? Where's Ilhan Omar rushing now to the defense of police officers? They love the police on January 6th. But then when it's against their cause, boy, they're right back to attacking them, showing their true colors. Talks about more protests at Yale and Columbia. This is just a few more details from the Wall Street Journal. It says students called Yale trustees and senior administrators terrorists. Their chants included, "There is only one solution, Intifada revolution, and from the river to the sea, Palestine is almost free." And they cornered a man at a plaza who was wearing a shirt that was against Hamas. And then the journal just weekly says, "This protest is in clear violation of Yale's code of conduct." I mean, it's getting worse and worse on these universities. It's so bad at Columbia that a rabbi who teaches there told Jewish students, don't come back onto this campus. You can read about that in the morning brief from the Trumpet that was sent out earlier today. It says, this rabbi is urging students to leave campus and go home due to growing threats of anti-Jewish violence by pro-Hamas provocateurs on the university's campus. Yeah, I'll just skip ahead here. It says, according to video footage posted on social media, the protesters attempted to break through the campus gate, chanting, break the lock, someone torch it, pick the lock. They also shouted, from the river to the sea. Oh, I read that. And then, there is only one solution, Intifada revolution. So this is an intifada in the streets of the United States, in New York City, in New Haven, Connecticut. Even Mayor Eric Adams, these Democrat mayors, they're having to come to terms with a lot of difficult things to justify in their own party that they promote. He's come out and he's had to talk about the border. I mean, a Democrat mayor talking about Biden failing at the border because this crisis is so overwhelming for them. And now he's got to face up against hordes of terrorist sympathizers, probably terrorists, roaming through the streets of New York City universities, chanting their support for a terrorist group that killed and murdered and raped thousands of Israelis. Mayor Adams says, I'm horrified and disgusted with the anti-Semitism being spewed at and around the Columbia University campus. Talks about that protester holding up the sign in front of the Israeli flag saying these are Hamas's next victims. The woman who said, we are Hamas. The massive group of students chanting, we don't want no Zionists here. This is a clip. Even, I mean, the regime media, there are a lot of people, a lot of Jewish people at MSNBC and CNN, Jake Tapper, they see this as a huge problem. I mean, they won't come out strongly against it, but again, you see that mood like, oh, this is getting pretty bad here. Here's just a clip. I think this was from MSNBC over the weekend. This is clip 3.
As a result, a rabbi at Columbia University is urging all Jewish students to return to their homes for their own safety. And this warning comes on the eve of the Jewish Passover holiday, which begins tomorrow night.
I mean, there's two principles that they need to uphold. Number one is freedom of speech, the freedom to peacefully assemble. But also, they need to draw the line when it comes to intimidation and violence. And I have to admit, as the son of a Jewish World War II veteran, I continue to be shocked, although perhaps I shouldn't be, by some of the anti-Semitic rhetoric and some of the hatred directed at Jews. It is one thing to disagree with Israeli foreign policy and to support Palestinian rights, but there have been occasions in which that has crossed the line. And I
These are the people that will say the worst things about Donald Trump. Remember the synagogue shooting a few years ago? That Donald Trump fueled that sort of rhetoric. Donald Trump, whose son-in-law is Jewish, Donald Trump fomenting anti-Semitism. Here you've got the worst examples, people targeting Jews on these campuses. And again, that's MSNBC, slightly concerned about it. It's kind of bad. This is exactly the sort of stuff that they're just hyperbolic about when it comes to Donald Trump. But then when it's the left, it is concerning. These are the people that promote those ideologies. These are the ones who fuel these revolutions on these campuses. And time and again, they get eaten up by these movements that they help create. This is the New York Post again. Columbia cancels in-person classes to reset as anti-Israel protests raise tensions. That was the strong move that the president of the university took. Classes are done for the day. Nobody come on campus. We're going back to virtual learning. It's back to lockdown mode because the anti-Semitism is so bad here. The embattled president of Columbia, I'm not going to be able to say her name, Manoush Shafiq, who has vowed to crack down on anti-Semitism, told students in an email that was also shared to the Ivy League's website that the school needs a reset as the increasing level of conflict has caused safety concerns for many students. She says, "I'm deeply saddened by what is happening on our campus. Our bonds as a community have been severely tested in ways that will take a great deal of time and effort to reaffirm." Can't come out strongly against the pro-genocide protesters. Can't come out strongly against the students saying, "I am Hamas." It's not safe. We're going to just pause it. We're going to let everybody cool down. We heard about it in the weeks following October 7th. I think it was the president of the University of Pennsylvania and then the president of Harvard, and I don't remember the third. But saying it calls for genocide, it doesn't really violate, you know, First Amendment or any of our campus policies. Now, if it turns into action, then it might be a problem for us. And a lot of those presidents have since lost their job. But this is, I mean, they're probably alumni of those universities, taught by the same radical professors, and they work their way up to become president of these universities. This is from someone, a reporter who I think she was a former student or was a part-time student, so she had a key card so she could get on campus and report on these protests. She writes, "On Thursday, I watched as NYPD officers in riot gear cleared a makeshift liberated zone encampment where students had pitched tents to protest Columbia's complicity in genocide. Eventually, around 100 anti-Israel protesters were arrested, one of them for repeatedly hitting a cop." So this is little, the summer of love happening on these campuses, fighting with police officers, beating police officers. Where's Nancy Pelosi to talk about this cop that was getting beaten by a protester? If it's January 6th, I mean, there'd be hearings already. The MAGA grandma would be in jail for walking through that open door. But if you're on the left, if it's anti-Semitism, you get a free pass. That's the reality of the Democrat Party in the United States. I had to comment on this story because one of those protesters, like I mentioned at the beginning, is the daughter of Ilhan Omar. And if you thought Ilhan Omar was oppressed, wait till you hear about her daughter who attends Columbia University. This is a new level of oppression, the likes of which we have never seen. And if you're surprised that Ilhan Omar has a daughter who is college age, I am too. I cannot understand Ilhan Omar's family situation. She came over as a teenager. I think she, on paper, marries her brother so that she can get a visa. I don't know how old she is when that happens. Now there's these kids that are happening out of wedlock, so they have different last names. I don't even know how the ages line up to where the daughter is as old as she is. I guess Ilhan would have been in her late teens when she had her anchor baby to stay in the United States. But just remember, this girl is supremely oppressed, having grown up in the United States. This is the Daily Beast. And they're right on board with Ilhan Omar's daughter being oppressed. Listen to this, the title of this article: Homeless, Zip-Tied, Hungry. Ilhan Omar's daughter recounts protest arrest. When Isra Hirsi joined several of her Barnard College and Columbia University peers in the pro-Palestinian campus protest known as the Gaza Encampment, she had no idea she would end up suspended, homeless, and left without food within a matter of days. This 21-year-old who is somehow managing to pay for, well, she's not paying for it, you are, because Joe Biden is excusing everybody's, or pardoning, or I don't even remember what the term is, paying for everyone's student debt using the taxpayer dollars from hardworking Americans who don't waste their time going to Columbia. $90,000 a year, and she gets arrested. So she's part of this revolt here, the encampment. It says early Thursday morning, just over 24 hours into the encampment, Hirsi, this is Omar's daughter, and the 100-plus other protesters were crammed into a corrections bus and sent downtown to One Police Plaza, a process that took up the entire day. Hirsi, Omar's daughter, says, "We had so many people who were born female in our group that they didn't have enough space for us. It was a very slow process in getting everybody into the cells." I don't know what having people born female has to do with them having enough space, but that's, I guess, how you would expect her to talk. She says, "I was zip-tied for about 7 hours and wasn't released for about 8. She says, "By the time she got out, 13 hours had gone past after she'd been arrested. But when she returned to campus, she found only more barriers." Hirsi knew that when she was suspended, it meant she no longer had access to her housing in the on-campus dorms. That meant she had lost all access to all her possessions and didn't know where she would find housing that night. College student, Columbia, couldn't call mom, who's probably making a lot of money as a congresswoman. Couldn't find housing that night. The oppressive NYPD are forcing these revolutionaries to have to find another place to sleep. This is the Daily Beast. To make matters worse, Hirsi also lost access to the dining hall as a result of her suspension, where she had been getting the majority of her meals. She said she appealed to the administration for help, but was ultimately left to fend for herself. "I sent them an email like, 'Hey, I rely on campus for my meals. I rely on my dining plan. I rely on my dining plan.'" And they were like, "Oh, you can, Columbia University." I think she's been there for 3 years. "Hey, I rely on campus for my meals. I rely on my dining plan." And they were like, "Oh, you can come pick up a prepackaged bag of food a full 48 hours after I was suspended. There was no food support, no nothing," she said. I mean, that that is the college-educated mind in the United States right now. I shouldn't be laughing. It's serious. It's sad that this is 3 years of Columbia. Can't figure out where she's going to sleep. Can't figure out how to eat without the precious Columbia University coddling to her every need. What is a grown woman to do? $90,000 a year. Here is a clip of she's coming. I mean, when she turns 25, I'm sure she's going to be running for Congress right there with Mama. But here she is. She's making a name for herself now. She was on MSNBC last night. Clip 4.
Do other student groups have this kind of target on their back, or do you feel that you are being targeted because of the fact that it is in solidarity with Palestinians and against what Israel is doing to Palestinians?
Oh, this is 100% targeted. Every single protest that we have, there's a group of counter-protesters that bring all of their items, their flags and things like that, and they're not seen as having unsanctioned protests or really receive the kind of disciplinary warnings that many of our fellow organizers receive just for being seen at these protests. And so there is definitely some hypocrisy here, especially you can kind of see it with the students that were sprayed us with the chemical weapons and the fact that there's no public information as to what happened to them, but rather the university is actively discussing what is happening to the students here and making it a whole public spectacle rather than when we haven't done anything to physically harm students, whereas those that sprayed those chemical weapons physically harmed students.
The hypocrisy, that's what she's complaining about. And this is, I mean, you look at the things her mother has said about 9/11, some people did some things. And some of those rallies where she speaks in her native tongue, I guess, I don't know the language of Somali. And on American soil, she's campaigning in a different language about how oppressive and evil America is. But they know what these universities are like. If America was so evil, would she really send her daughter to Columbia? Where does she get the money to pay for that is another thing. They know what goes on at Columbia. They know what those professors are like. Obama knew what Columbia was like. He loved it there. Donald Trump, following this weekend, this intifada in the United States in some senses, he posted this over the weekend. Why are Palestinian protesters and even rioters allowed to roam the cities, scream, shout, sit, block traffic, enter buildings, not get permits, and basically do whatever they want, including threatening Supreme Court justices right in front of their homes? I mean, this was January 6th. All of those protesters, they had a permit to be there. They had a permit to be on the grounds around the Capitol. Not these protesters, not these rioters. President Trump says, and yet people who truly love our country and want to make America great again are not allowed to peacefully protest and are rudely and systematically shut down and ushered off to faraway holding areas. Look at some of the anti-abortion protesters. All they do is sit on a curb outside some of these clinics and they get FBI SWAT teams knocking down their front door because it's a violation of the FACE Act. Threatened with hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines and up to 11 years in jail. President Trump essentially denying them their constitutional rights. America-loving protesters should be allowed to protest at the front of the steps of courthouses all over the country. He's saying this because they have locked down Lower Manhattan. It's totally possible to lock it down to prevent pro-Trump supporters from showing up at that courthouse. Mayor Eric Adams has the means to stop protesters quite easily. And the optics, the images of thousands of people lining up on the sidewalks to support Donald Trump is pretty bad for Democrats. So they'll say, it's in the best interest of the public that we just lock it down. No one's allowed in. Donald Trump, he is an outcast. The people of Harlem don't like Donald Trump. Just like it is allowed for those who are destroying our country on the radical left, a two-tiered system of justice, free speech and assembly has been chilled for USA supporters. He says, go out and peacefully protest. There it is. I'm sure all over CNN and MSNBC today. I haven't watched it yet. There he is. The dog whistle for more rioters. The dog whistle for another January 6th. He says, rally behind MAGA. Save our country. The only thing you have to fear is fear itself. I saw just this morning, Mr. Palmer sent it over in the news about the United States sanctioning a battalion of the Israeli Defense Forces, not going after the pro-Hamas terrorists walking through the streets of New York City. That's free speech. They're going after the ones fighting them in Israel. This is from December of 2023. This was written by Mr. Joel Hilliker. It was at the Trumpet. It says, the sickness in American universities is worse than we thought. He writes, these schools are not merely morally perverse, they are intellectually and academically bankrupt, having banished absolute truth and God from their reasoning. These academics and intellectuals have become untethered from reality. All society must understand this and stop entrusting these people with educating our children. Ilhan Omar, she knows where she's sending her daughter for school. She knows that she's not going to be fed a steady diet of America First, of the Constitution, of why the founders were so great. She knows why her daughter's going to Columbia. But a lot of parents, they don't. They still like the brand of Harvard and Yale and Columbia. And then their kids come out and they're doing what you saw over the weekend at Columbia and Yale. How much damage can misguided and arrogant intellectuals do? Mr. Hilliker writes, as historian Niall Ferguson reminded us in his December 10th article, this is of 2023, intellectuals in Germany and throughout the Western world embraced a certain ideology in the 1930s. German universities were the best in the world, far better than Harvard and Yale, and when this ideology began spreading through the nation, the presidents, department chairs, and professors guiding the arts, languages, history, law, religion, anthropology, economics, government, sociology, science, mathematics, and engineering found much to praise. Many university-educated lawyers and doctors devoted themselves to this way of thinking to the point of joining the party. Later, this ideology would become infamous, Nazism. And it was will worship. That swarmed through that nation, and it started a lot of it in those universities because the elite liked it. And as much as MSNBC and CNN scream about Donald Trump, this is everything they accuse him of is happening in their own party. Speaking of these universities, speaking of worshiping of the will, we commented, Mr. Fleury commented a bit on the NPR debacle and about this editor, really high-ranking editor who wrote this opinion piece about how biased and how just awful NPR has become. The 84 Democrats in their newsroom and there are zero Republicans. Now, he was suspended for writing that article, and then he announced recently that he's just resigned from his position. It says NPR, this is CNN, just talking about that editor, Yuri Berliner, being suspended, and then he just quit. And then as this is happening, more people are starting to look at the CEO of NPR, just like when the Columbia University or University of Pennsylvania, those Ivy League schools, and people start digging into, well, wait a second, Claudine Gay, the president of, I think that was Harvard, she's plagiarizing all of her work. And people started looking into this CEO of NPR, and it's right out of the left-wing playbook. It's exactly what you would expect from one of these Ivy League graduates. I think this CEO, she went to New York University, and this is not just her. She's a product of this system. She's only been the CEO for a month. But NPR, if you spent any time listening to it, if you want news and you're in the car, that's really the only thing that's available. And that was crazy left-wing 20 years ago. It was hard to listen to it at points. Now it's just, I stopped 2 or 3 years ago because they could not infuse race into every single story. Had to be about race, and it's just it's unbearable. You couldn't listen to it. So for the people that are shocked that this is happening at NPR, you probably haven't been paying that close attention to NPR. And you can be forgiven for that because it's hard to listen to. This is the New York Times. The tweets and the posts from this CEO were so bad that even the New York Times had to cover it. It says NPR CEO faces criticism over tweets supporting progressive causes. Catherine Mayer, who took over the public network last month, again, this is your tax dollars paying for this, posted years ago on Twitter that Donald Trump is a racist. No surprise there. That's the way all of them think. She tweeted in May of 2020, I mean, this is the after the summer of love, and all the Democrats are coming out to try to justify looting and why it's a form of reparations. She says, I mean, sure, looting is counterproductive, but it's hard to be mad about protests not prioritizing the private property of a system of oppression founded on treating people's ancestors as private property. A few years before that, she says, I do wish Hillary wouldn't use the language of boy and girl. It's erasing language for non-binary people. July 2020, lots of jokes about leaving the U.S., and I get it, but as someone with cis white mobility privilege, yeah, whatever that is, I'm thinking I'm staying and investing in ridding ourselves of this spectra of tyranny. She probably got the job because of tweets like that. I mean, if you're a normal thinking person, I don't know what cis white mobility privilege means to you. Just a lot of gobbledygook coming from people who, she went to New York University, another prestigious university in New York there. And she's perfect for the job at MP. She's hired because of that, I'm sure. And people have been digging up some of the things that she said. And they're like all of them, they're just little mini Obamas, the way they go around talking about the truth. This is a longer clip. This is something that she said in 2021 that was brought back up just a couple of, or I think it was just last week. But this is Catherine Mayer, the CEO of NPR in 2021, clip 6.
Because in our normal lives, these contentious conversations tend to erupt over disagreement about what the truth actually is. But the people who write these articles, they're not focused on the truth. They're focused on something else, which is the best of what we can know right now. And after 7 years of working with these brilliant folks, I've come to believe that they are onto something, that perhaps for our most tricky disagreements, seeking the truth and seeking to convince others of the truth might not be the right place to start. In fact, our reverence for the truth might be a distraction that's getting in the way of finding common ground and getting things done. Now, that is not to say that the truth doesn't exist, nor is it to say that the truth isn't important. Clearly, the search for the truth has led us to do great things, to learn great things. But I think if I were to really ask you to think about this, one of the things that we could all acknowledge is that part of the reason we have such glorious chronicles to the human experience and all forms of culture is because we acknowledge there are many different truths. And so in the spirit of that, I'm certain that the truth exists for you and probably for the person sitting next to you. But this may not be the same truth. This is because the truth of the matter is very often, for many people, what happens when we merge facts about the world with our beliefs about the world. So we all have different truths. They're based on things like where we come from, how we were raised, and how other people perceive us.
That was hard to listen to, primarily because she talks to people like they're six. I don't even talk to my kid like that. I mean, it's so pandering, and she's so intellectual and smart and snobbish. But I mean, if you can focus and listen to the words and not zone out, because that it's hard to listen to, seeking the truth and seeking to convince others of the truth might not be the right place to start. She's talking about, I think she used to work at Wikipedia, and she was talking about how they would have to fact check things. If you don't start with truth as the foundation, an absolute truth, you can't build anything. It just leads to destruction. But she says, seeking the truth and seeking to convince others of the truth might not be the right place to start. In fact, our reverence for the truth might be a distraction. There has to be absolute truth. She says, because we acknowledge there are many different truths, and so in the spirit of that, I'm certain that the truth exists for you and probably for the person sitting next to you, but this may not be the same truth. This is crazy. This is will worship. And once you go down that path, there's no stopping what you will justify. There's no stop. I mean, they will justify the anti-Semitism at Columbia. And they will justify putting Jews in camps. And they will justify death camps. Because there's no absolute truth. Well, what I believe, I can believe whatever I want, and you're free to believe whatever you want. There is no truth. What a dangerous, dangerous way to think. Where is that coming from? I'm sure a lot of that is from the universities, but look again. We talked about this clip a lot at the time. This was Barack Obama at Stanford. This was a year or two ago, what he said. Notice how closely, you know, their thinking aligns. This is clip 5.
It's a chance for journalists and their supporters to figure out, how do we adapt old institutions and those core values that made those institutions valuable? How do we adapt that to a new age? It is a chance for all of us to fight for truth. Not absolute truth. Not a fixed truth, but to fight for what deep down we know is more true, is right. It's a chance for us to do that, not just because we're afraid of what will happen if we don't, but because we're hopeful about what can happen if we do. You know, over the last couple of months, we've seen what it looks like when a society loses the ability to distinguish truth from fiction.
It's kind of the same, almost the exact same tone as that Catherine Mayer. It's hard to listen to, but listen to what they're saying, and it's awful. It's destructive. There is no fixed truth. We need to fight for what deep down we know is more true. It's your truth. Over the last couple of months, we've seen what it looks like when a society loses the ability to distinguish truth from fiction. What does that mean when you're saying that there is no fixed truth? How can you have a fact checker when what you say is that their truth is whatever it means to you? It's your truth. I mean, that girl, I think she's in her early 40s. Obama, I think he's in his 60s now. In Columbia, Obama went to Columbia. It's taught in the universities. There is no fixed truth, and that is a dangerous, terrifying road to go down. This is Mr. Gerald Fleury in the March 2024 Trumpet in an article titled "The Unknown Future of Artificial Intelligence." And he talks about that quote, that clip that we just played from Barack Obama, and how much these people want control. They want control of the internet. They want control of social media. They want control of artificial intelligence because they can't risk that absolute truth getting out. They have to feed you their truth. They have to feed you their will. Mr. Fleury writes, think about this. This man, Barack Obama, spread lies about Donald Trump being a Russian agent, about the 2020 election being secure, about the vaccines being safe, about January 6, 2021 being an insurrection, and so much more. To him, absolute truths don't matter. What matters is what you feel is more true deep down. Is he really one to be lecturing us about trying to prevent truth from being blurred with lies? There is absolute truth. Only God can define what is truth and what is error. When individuals try to define fact and fiction, there is a diabolical spirit behind their actions and how they lie. They will lie about anything, and they will lie right to your face, and they know they're lying. And I had some clips, some more to play along those lines, but maybe we can take a short break, and then we'll just cover one more story for the time that we have remaining on today's show. Again, any comments that you have, send those to td@thetrumpet.com. We'll be right back.
Daily News, Bible Prophecy. See the connection on The Trumpet Daily.
Are you feeling overwhelmed by the flood of news and information? You need something to sift the news and bring you only what matters most. You need the Trumpet Daily. You also need something to help you understand not just what's happening now, but what will happen next. You need the Trumpet Daily. Only the Trumpet Daily accurately matches daily news to precise Bible prophecies. Because Bible prophecy is the only tool up to the task of sifting the news down to what's important and showing you what will happen next. Join host Stephen Fleury every weekday. Go to trumpetdaily.com.
Welcome back. This is a story that you probably haven't heard a whole lot about. It's taking place in North Africa in a country called Niger. I will try to say it the way the internet told me to say it. If I was just looking at it as an American, I would say Niger. But the internet, the Google, told me that it is a French nation pronounced Niger. The Associated Press says the U.S. military will begin plans to withdraw troops from Niger. The United States will begin plans to withdraw troops from Niger, U.S. officials said Saturday, and what experts say is a blow to Washington and its allies in the region in terms of staging security operations in the Sahel. The planned departure comes as U.S. officials said they were trying to find a new military agreement. The Sahel, that's that southern coastline, you could call it, of the Sahara Desert. So that area is there's filled with terror organizations. I think Nigeria, they've still got Boko Haram, and ISIS even operates over there. So the United States has a pretty sizable base there with 1,000 troops. It's a drone base, allows them to surveil a lot of these groups. The Europeans had quite a few soldiers based in this area as well. But there was a coup in Niger last year, and that coup was backed by Russia. And now the Russians are training the new government in Niger. They're training them how to operate weapons. And essentially, Russia, kind of like they did in Syria in 2013, they're coming in and they're taking over. They're pushing the Europeans out. They're pushing the Americans out. And the Americans, you haven't heard a lot about it, they've basically been held hostage on this base for the last year as they try to negotiate what to do here, what to do with this base. And the United States is trying to, I'd imagine, prevent another Kabul-type withdrawal, like the disaster there. It says a U.S. official said there is no timeline for withdrawal besides talks set to start in the coming days about next steps. Niger plays a central role in the U.S. military's operations in Africa's Sahel region. It says the U.S. has also invested hundreds of millions of dollars in training Niger's military since it began operations there in 2013. Another example of America's strength spent in vain. Hundreds of millions of dollars. You can see this base. You can see it on Google Maps. It's a huge base. It's in the middle of the desert, outside of the city, and it's primarily for operating drones so that the United States can monitor what these terror groups are doing in the region. But the United States has basically given that nation up to a Russian-backed coup. And now an anti-American government is in charge there. And this nation is hugely important. They have a lot of natural gas, a lot of uranium. They're planning to build a railway from this nation to the north coast of Africa to supply energy to Europe, because Europe, who is so reliant on Russia, has to find other sources of energy. And now Russia swoops in there and gets this huge victory, further cutting off Europe. And it's going to make Europe more desperate. But I wanted to just look at the United States, again, under Joe Biden, being pushed out. The Associated Press says the loss of access to airbases in Niger is a major setback for the U.S. and its allies in the region because of its strategic location for security operations, says Peter Pham, former U.S. Special Envoy. In the short term, they will be hard to replace, he says, adding that remaining European Union military presence would likely pull out of Niger following the news of a U.S. departure. Mr. Palmer wrote about this last October in an article titled Why Niger is a Catastrophe for Europe. He talks about the energy projects that were going on there, the pipeline for natural gas that was going from Nigeria to Algeria would pass through Niger. Now that's in jeopardy. Russia could turn off that pipeline the same way it could through Ukraine or on the Nord Stream pipeline. Mr. Palmer says, if it can dominate Niger, Russia can better keep Europe over a barrel or over a gas cylinder. And then he quotes Mr. Gerald Fleury from 2013, Northern Africa is turning into a battleground with enormously important prophetic implications. And then Mr. Palmer talks about how this is a French nation and France, they've been trying to get out of there, and how Europe is going to have to come up with a new strategy. They've got to, as we've been covering on this show and at the trumpet, Europe is going to have to develop a military. They're going to have to get a backbone to confront Russia, to confront now what's coming up from the south as well. But like I said earlier, this is, I wanted to just focus for a couple minutes on America being absent, America being pushed out, another huge base that the United States is going to have to abandon. I don't know if they'll do it the same way they did it in Afghanistan, but this is a huge base, and they'll probably leave a lot of equipment there for another hostile power, another terror group to take control of. Leviticus 26 and verse 19 says, and I will break the pride of your power. Verse 20 says, and your strength shall be spent in vain. These are curses. America being pushed out. And look at the chaos that follows. This is from January 2014. It's again an article by Mr. Joel Hilliker. And this is a fantastic Trumpet magazine to revisit. It's titled, What Happens After a Superpower Dies. The world is about to find out. And this was written after that Syria red line. This was written after Russia invaded Ukraine. And you could see the chaos that was coming because the United States was backing off of the world stage. And we're entering into the times of the Gentiles when these other powers would dominate. Mr. Hilliker writes, what happens when a superpower dies? What happens when the geopolitical order that has stabilized the world for several decades crumbles? We are about to learn firsthand. For most of the past century, the United States of America has been the world's single greatest guarantor of global stability. Then he talks about how America has no more credibility. That credibility has been shattered. And this was 10 years ago. And you could go back and you could find articles about this, you know, 50, 60 years ago from Mr. Armstrong and The Plain Truth, and now The Trumpet, because this news or this forecasting is informed by Bible prophecy. And this is what the Bible said would happen to the United States as a curse. Mr. Hilliker says, you may realize that America just isn't what it used to be, but you probably do not grasp half the magnitude of this historical turning point. America's critics and enemies are heartened. They are thrilled to watch America fade and are working hard to erase its influence completely. Remarkably, even most Americans are relieved that the U.S. is relinquishing its powerful role. The big question now is what happens next? Again, that article is 10 years old. And look at what is happening. You need Bible prophecy. If you haven't, read the King of the South booklet. It gives you a lot of detail on these events. And what the Bible says in a broader sense, the trends of where these events are leading. That is all that I have time for on today's show. I hope you join us later on this week. I hope you join us tomorrow. Again, if you have any comments for the show, send those to td@thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll see you tomorrow.